Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate you for sharing part of your beautiful Saturday afternoon with us here. It's still chilly out there, but it is looking like springtime, and I think we're all getting excited about that. Lots to do on the show today, and we have a little bit longer show. Instead of ending things at 1 and turning things over to the Startup Showcase with Scott Catoon, I'm just going to keep on going until 1:30 and then turn you over to pregame for the Blackhawks. So look for that. Lots extra time, all the things to talk about, many extra topics. And that's good because we need all that time because we have lots to do on the show today. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about co-working spaces. We're going to be taking a look at why paper mills, some are reopening even after so many closed in recent years. And we're going to take a look at a company that is helping retailers interact with virtual reality and interact with their customers that way. So tons to do today. But right now we're joined by Corinne Pertil, a reporter at Quartz, who wrote a piece about swingline staplers. If you know the movie Office Space, you remember the iconic red swingline stapler. Well, turns out they didn't even make red swingline staplers at the time. And so we're going to take a look at that because now that is one of their top selling products for sure. Corinne, welcome to the program. So glad you're here with us today. Uh-oh, do we have you? Are you there?
I'm here, yeah. Oh,
there you are. Hi, how are you?
Hi there, how are you doing?
Great. I have to tell you, for those of you who are following me on Twitter, I have already tweeted this story out about the swingline staplers because it's so wonderfully written and it was such a joy to read. I really appreciate you joining us to talk about it today. So tell us about Office Space has just turned 20, and tell us about the trajectory of the swingline stapler and how it was even involved in the film and what happened after all of that branding happened around it.
Yeah, absolutely. So when Mike Judge and producers were making Office Space, and all of this is detailed in a great oral history of the movie on the website The Ringer, by anyone who's a fan of the film, I would suggest you go check that out. I got to give them credit. And they wanted sort of for the kind of verisimilitude, they wanted a real stapler company to reference for this very sort of key motif in the film, which is this very desperate, bumbling employee's prized stapler. And so they went to Boston, which makes staplers, and Boston said, no, you cannot have our name. And they went to Bostitch, and Bostitch said, no, you can't have our name either. And so then they went to Swingline, which was, a manufacturer of staplers and three-hole punches and very respectful office supplies, which said, sure, you can, you're free to use our name to reference our name in this film. But as you said, Swingline only made staplers at the time in gray or blue, kind of this very dull palette that the movie was sort of parodying, and they needed something that really popped on screen. And so the prop department kind of put some Bondo putty on it, so they wanted to sort of reshape the stapler. They moved the logo, and then they painted it bright red. And so that's where the stapler of Office Space fame was born.
It's such a charming story. I love reading this. It's so very funny. Now, it's interesting how at the time they were kind of resistant to the idea of having anything officially licensed because it's kind of a raunchy movie. It's a great movie, but it's kind of a raunchy movie in parts. And so they were a little hesitant to get involved. But now how that's evolved to being such a top-selling product.
Exactly. And they had consented to the use of their name, but, as far as any sort of licensed, products, they had turned that down. Also, it was not necessarily the type of film you would expect licensed products to come out of. It bombed at the box office when it first came out. And you don't really think of a branded stapler as something that's going to become this, cult product, but they noticed after a few years, as the movie started to pick up all this momentum on DVD and word of mouth and, airings on Comedy Central, two things started happening. They started being bombarded by requests for red staplers, which they still didn't make, and they started noticing all of these swingline knockoffs popping up over the internet. So it took about 10 years after the film came out, but they now offer the 747, their classic stapler model, in a bright red color. And so that has been on, and it's not necessarily marketed as Milton Stapler or anything. It's just a red swing line. And if you know what you're looking for, you certainly would know that that's the one one you want. And then in honor of the 20th anniversary that happens this year, they're offering one that a much cheaper model. The original stapler is, I think, close to $50. It's a high-end stapler. A much cheaper model that looks just like Milton's actual stapler.
I feel like that's going to be snapped up by a lot of people. I mean, I would buy the red stapler. That sounds great. And it's so interesting.
Yes, happily.
It's so interesting that this movie has the staying power that it does. I mean, I was talking about this film probably just a couple of months ago with friends because somebody in the group quoted it, and it still works. And so much to it is, I think, so many people connect with even today about just the workplace and the structure of workplace and sometimes monotony of the workplace and things like that. I think this film really has wonderful staying power, even though it was not that well received at the box office initially.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it really does. It holds up so well. Even though if you watch it now, you know, you notice obviously the technology has far moved on. There's no, the annoying boss leaves, you know, voicemail messages on a home answering machine instead of bombarding the, you know, their employee's email. But it all still works. I mean, this, you know, in the film, this kind of gray cubicle jungle is sort of stand in for this like frustrating, despairing workplace environment. And now those have all been switched out with open plan offices, but that feeling of being in a cubicle is still there, really, no matter how you change an office around. So yeah, it's an amazing movie. It totally holds up.
Absolutely. And it's really done wonders for the red stapler. There's a line in this piece I want to read that's so funny. It says, in the piece, and you're talking about why some stapler companies were initially resistant to being involved. It says, furthermore, the swing line stapler that appears in the film is no hero. And then it goes on to say, it's a bright red totem of despair, which is such a beautiful line. I love that. That's so well done. So again, those of you who follow me on Twitter, be sure and check out this story. It's up there right now. It's my most recent tweet. So you can read this story for yourself. Thank you so much for being with us, Corinne Pertil, reporter at Quartz. Hope we can talk to you again sometime.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about a company that uses virtual reality simulations to help retailers improve customer experience. We're going to find out what that's all about when we come back on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your afternoon. Always grateful to you for that. Lots to do on the show today. And reminder that we're going, instead of 1, we're going up to 1:30 today. I will take you right up to that pregame with Chris Bowden. And then I'll come right back from 8 to 9 this evening for a shortened Saturday night special. Lots to do this afternoon, though. We're joined now by Tracy Wademeyer, Chief Technical Officer and co-founder of In Context Solutions, a company that uses virtual reality simulations to help retailers improve their customer experience. Let's find out what that's all about. Tracy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be here.
So talk us through this company and how you interact with retailers and help them interact with their customers.
Yeah, so we've been in business for about 10 years now, you know, and I think as retailers and even brands have had competitive pressures from digital properties like Amazon and so forth, they just need to move faster. You know, they need to get ideas to market in their brick and mortar stores much quicker than in the past. So the approach we've taken, there's a couple different ways we go about it. So one of them is basically using virtual technologies for simulating what you might want to do in your brick and mortar stores. So this is anything from, you know, packaging, promotion, signage, wayfinding, end caps, anything you really are thinking about putting in front of your customer at the shelf, or even in the store. We're helping retailers simulate that so they understand, you know, first off, what it looks like. And then what we can do is take that simulation technology, essentially wrap it into a video game, put it on a website, put some web-based surveys around it, and have thousands of people from the comfort of their own home, you know, take part in that video game, and we measure what they pick up and buy, what do they look at, and then we can correlate that back to your brand strategy or private label strategy. You know, did they recognize your product? Did they pick it up and put it back on the shelf? Why was that? That type of thing. And we're really shortening that go-to-market merchandising process from, you know, 6 months down to, you know, as little as, you know, 6 weeks.
And so who are some of the companies that you're working with now and where we can interact with some of this technology?
So traditionally, we've worked with a lot of brands. They've been a little more progressive the last decade in using this technology. Retailers, I would say, have been laggards up until the last 2 or 3 years. So we're seeing companies like Walgreens, Home Depot, Walmart, that flavor of company use this technology to just plan merchandising a lot quicker. So there's likely merchandising strategies that have been deployed already that are part of our technology in some of these channels and chains that you're not aware of, that it was done with a virtual headset or a, you know, a VR project or a study, but you know, they're using it to lift their sales or maintain competitive advantage.
I would love to know a little bit more about the origin here of how you came to create this technology and the idea, since you're the co-founder, of how, you know, how you had this spark of an idea of, you know, this is a thing we're going to do, and I know we can fix a problem for retailers and for customers.
Yeah, back in 2008 or 2009, when we really got the idea going, the latest version of this technology was doing what they were calling on-premise surveying. So they would do mall intercepting. They'd set up a couple 55-inch panels in a mall and tap you on the shoulder as you're walking through and try to get you to come to a back room and look at some ideas on a flat screen. And that was really slow. It was really expensive. You know, and with the coming of the Internet and bandwidth, you know, working in our favor, we said, hey, I think we can do that over the web. You know, and we can reach anybody anywhere for a fraction of the cost. So we started out more as a services company doing market research projects for brands and retailers, and that kind of dwarfed into an enterprise platform. Customers eventually said, hey, can we do what you guys are doing without you in the middle? And, of course, we said yes, built a product around it in an enterprise platform, and now that's a larger part of our platform and our business.
I know that we have a lot of small business owners who listen to this program. So for those who might be curious about your product, what is that kind of startup like, and or the startup process like, and what size of a business is kind of the ideal customer for you?
We, you know, right now our core business is, say, Fortune 100 brands and retailers, and I think we're getting into the mid-market space for a number of reasons now. One of them is, traditionally, the cost of 3D content. So when I say 3D content, think of a 3D can of Coke or a 3D box of Cheerios or Wheaties that we have to simulate and put on the shelf. You have to replicate all those in 3D. And the cost for those used to be quite high. Now with depth sensing cameras and a lot of automation behind that, that we've done some as well as other companies that we work with, we're getting the cost of that content down to a few dollars. So now we're starting to see that kind of the cross of a chasm for a lot of these mid-market companies who can now afford this, and they're often the ones that are more nimble than these larger brands, bringing really creative ideas to the retailers themselves.
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go next with that, and I'm curious about what kind of ideas, you know, what about maybe the most creative uses that you've seen of this so far in working with all these brands?
Yeah, so I think the, you know, there's no surprise the center store grocery is kind of eroding with, you know, Amazon Prime and shipping and, you know, people are buying paper towels and things like that online. So why would you go into the store? So I think what a lot of brands and retailers are confronted with now is how do I reuse that center store space? So you're starting to see things like, you know, 68 feet of aisle turned at a 45-degree angle, or let's remove a couple of the aisles and put in breakfast bars where you can get food on the go. There's another retailer out there using that space to bring in five-star chefs to teach you how to grill your steaks. So there's a much, it's much more of an event and a memory that they're trying to create to get you to come back to that brand over and over again. So a couple other examples are, you know, something as simple as putting, you know, fruit in the beverage alcohol section. You know, you want limes with your beer, lemons, you know, those types of things that have been tested on our platform that may have been obvious before, but it, you know, allowed them to get a number of consumer feedback data points that helped strengthen the decision.
I'm endlessly fascinated about the evolution of retail in particular, but shopping at all, as shopping and technology and consumer behavior has all swirled together in such an interesting way. So I appreciate talking with you today. I will be sure and tweet out, and we're going to have a link to the website on the WGN Radio website, of course, too. But for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I've already sent a tweet with a link to all this if you're interested. Go for it. Find me on Twitter and you can read more about this company. Tracy Wademeyer, Chief Technical Officer and co-founder of InContext Solutions. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today and sharing part of your afternoon. Lots to do still on the show today, and remind you that we're going to go to 1:30 today instead of stopping at 1 o'clock, so we get some extra time to talk about more things. Right now, we're joined by Michael Corkery, reporter at New York Times, who wrote about how a boom in cardboard sales is helping keep paper mills from closing and even reopening some of them. We think about paper mills as being kind of a thing that's in great peril now. A lot of them have closed. We've seen so many of them shuttered. But to think of some of them reopening, let's find out why. Michael, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hello. Thank you.
Certainly. So talk us through this story. I've already tweeted this out. So for those of you who follow me on social media, you can read this really excellent long read for yourself, because there's so much information here. We think of cardboard being so simple and straightforward, but there's really quite a lot going on here.
Yes. So as you mentioned in your intro, paper, as your listeners can probably imagine, in this digital age, paper sales in the paper industry is quite challenged. We just use a lot less of it, your printing paper, your newsprint. And so for the paper industry in Wisconsin, which is the largest place where paper is made in the country, it's been a tough time. And then enters e-commerce and Amazon, that started using a lot of brown paper for its boxes. And what that has brought to the paper industry is this sort of a second life. And many mills, including this mill that I visited in Combined Locks, Wisconsin, in the Fox River Valley, has switched a lot of its production over from white paper to brown paper to take advantage of this box boom. And it's a bit of a twist, because we think of Amazon, as a job displacer in the retail industry, helping to close stores, and as people shop more online and less in stores. But in this case, it's actually creating jobs in kind of an old line industry of paper.
And as you were working on this story and as you were doing this reporting, what was immediately the most surprising thing to you, other than, hey, cardboard's having a comeback?
Well, I think one of the things that I was really struck by is, so much of manufacturing now is automated, and humans have very little role, and it's flawless, whether they're making cars or machinery. But in paper, it's a really fascinating science, and still largely an art form. I mean, there's this huge production line of essentially wood and water and heat, and the smallest thing can go wrong, like a little too much water or a little bacteria, and this paper just doesn't get created. And it was really interesting spending a week or so with the paper makers, as they're known and have been through history, and even still today, very proudly think of themselves as paper makers, not like assembly line workers. It's still very much a craft that they're working on. And I really, seeing that as part of their identity and the community's identity was really cool. And I think part of what makes this such a nice story, broadly as a business story, is that it's coming back and they're finding a new life for this craft in brown paper.
Right. And that really stuck out to me, of how many very human, very emotional stories were tied to this mill where you were talking about people meeting their spouse there and people working there three generations in a row and having these really emotional connections to this craft of making paper. I thought that was so fascinating.
Yes, definitely. And it's, that area, it sort of stretches from Green Bay in the north down to Neenah, or even a little further south into Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I mean, all up and down there, it's all tied into paper. And I think, you know, when you sort of, you know, as a reporter coming in there for the first time, just meeting people, you know, whether it's just walking around town or going to a supper club, or, you know, everybody in some way that you sort of meet is somehow tied into that industry. And, you know, it's just things you sort of take for granted. You know, it's like, you know, it's tissues, or it's, I met somebody else who was, you know, works at a company where they make the paper that goes down on, you know, the doctor's examining table. You know, all these things in our everyday life, a lot of them come from that part of Wisconsin. And then you kind of dig a little deeper and see just the history of that going all the way back to the, you know, late 19th century, post-Civil War, all the mills opening up, all the wood that was sort of ample in that part of Wisconsin, and the river powering the mills, and bringing it to present day. It's really, really fascinating.
And if you could, give us a sense of volume. So we saw this downturn in paper production. There was a lot of communities that were hit very hard by layoffs and paper mill closures. And now that we're seeing this uptick, did you get a sense of just how much paper is being made now in this kind of paper revival?
Well, I mean, I think just if you just look at brown paper, so which is what that's, you know, going toward all these boxes. I mean, that, you know, this is not like gangbuster growth, you know, double digit kind of things. I mean, this is paper. But it's, you know, it's doubled. I mean, it was like, you know, growing at a steady sort of 2%, and then along comes Amazon, and now we're up to 5% a year. Again, not huge numbers, but in this sort of steady plodding, you know, old line industry, that's big growth. But then if you get into sort of the raw numbers of just how much more boxes have been added since really e-commerce took off in 2014, started becoming like basically a part of so many people's lives and how they shop. I mean, they've added 23 billion square feet extra of box capacity. I mean, these are huge numbers, and, you know, the brown paper that these mills, these big, huge rolls of brown paper, that's the sort of starting point for these boxes, and that's what these guys are pumping out.
Again, it's such a fascinating thing. We don't think about cardboard and brown paper having such a rich life, but indeed it does. So I appreciate you being with us today to talk about this story. And again, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I've already tweeted it out so you can find it for yourself and give it a read, because it's really well done and really, really fascinating. Michael Corkery, reporter at New York Times, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are talking about stores that are trying to get rid of the checkout line. We've seen them pop up, so let's talk about them a little bit more. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. A little bit longer show today. We're with you until 1:30. We're going to talk it right up to pregame with Chris Bowden, and then you're going to have some Blackhawks, then some White Sox Weekly, then I'm coming back at 8 o'clock. So a little different schedule today, but it's all good because that means springtime and sports and all that good stuff is happening. We're joined now by regular contributor to this program and business reporter at Chicago Tribune, Lauren Zumbach, who wrote recently about stores that are trying to get rid of the checkout lane. We've seen these pop up. We've seen them around. There's one right here in this same building where WGN is housed now, and we've seen them, and I think people are very curious about them. So, Lauren, welcome back to the show. What did you find in taking a look at stores that are thinking about or have already made the plunge of getting rid of those checkout lines?
Well, yeah. So even though self-checkout has been around for a while, we're seeing more and more retailers take an interest in trying to do away with that. Because even if you love to shop, by the time you've got your stuff and are ready to pay, no one wants to see that big line stretching through the front of the store. So, yeah, when you mentioned that there's one in WGN's building, I'm guessing you're talking about Amazon Go?
That's the one.
That's the one, yes. So that is probably the example that's taken it furthest so far. With Amazon Go, there's four stores in Chicago. And the idea is that if you're a member, you can walk in, scan an app on your phone, and once you're in the store, you walk around, you take what you like, and when you're done, you walk back out through the gate, and there's no formal checkout at all. It just charges your account later.
See, that's been a little intimidating. Like, I saw that store open, and I thought, I have questions, but I'm scared to walk in because there's no one to answer them for me. I don't know what to do.
Right, and I did talk to actually more than one person who said that it did feel a little bit like shoplifting the first time.
Yeah.
But at least when it was new, they did actually have a couple of employees stationed at the front to just sort of walk people through it and reassure them, like, no, you really can't just leave. So that's definitely the highest tech solution, but it's also part of the reason that it's not a great fit for every store just yet. You know, the way that they do it is, there's, if you look up when you're shopping there, there's a lot of cameras on the ceiling. There's sensors and then more cameras on the shelves. It's how they track and, you know, follow as you, you know, when you pick up one item and know what to bill you for later. That works pretty well for these convenience stores, which are really pretty small, the ones they've opened so far. But it's more expensive and more complicated to scale that up to something like, you know, a Walmart superstore in the suburbs.
Right. Which you mentioned, I think it was Meyer in the story that you wrote about how there's a lot of space to cover. That's a lot of people to watch. There's a lot going on there. And then you get into other complicated stuff when you're in the store fooling with the app. Like, for the most part, you're going to be able to find the barcode, but sometimes there's a weird thing, like a weird produce item or something, and you're going to kind of struggle with how to address that.
Yeah. So the way that Meyer is tackling this is it's a bit more of an incremental improvement on the self-checkout that you might have seen before. So instead of going and, you know, you shop and you have to take all your items out when you get to the self-checkout kiosk at the end of your trip and scan them all there, Meijer has an app where you can scan a barcode on the product as you're walking through the store and putting it in your cart. So in theory, you know, it saves you that scanning step at the end. Also makes it easier to find the coupons. But yeah, like you said, it's great when you're buying stuff that's, you know, packaged and already has that handy barcode right there. You know, there's a little bit more work involved when it's something like, you know, buying fruits and vegetables by the pound. You know, definitely no more work than the self-checkout that you're used to. But that was part of the reason that the shoppers that I talked to there, you know, seemed maybe open to the idea. They already like self-checkout, but didn't know that this was enough of a leap forward that they were really excited about it, the way you saw people getting excited about the first Amazon Go store that came to Chicago.
Yeah, I think it's so funny, like the self-checkout thing. I usually go that route myself, and I think it is fascinating to watch human behavior in a couple of moments in our lives. One of them is at airports. As soon as that door opens for us to board the plane, we act ridiculous, trying to all crowd into that plane like we're all going to get on. The other one is at the self-checkout line. It's like, I don't want to talk to people and deal with another human being. I'm just going to scan my things. But the minute something doesn't scan or it says, oh, the weight's wrong, you know, you didn't put it in your shopping bag or something, people really get unhinged. So it's like, I don't want people until I really need them, and then I want them right now.
You want them to just fix it all for you. Absolutely.
It's fascinating. I mean, people, it's like a very triggering behavior for people at that moment. Like, my thing is not working the way it's supposed to. Someone, I need help right now. And I think it's a fascinating
thing. If it's the kind that shouts at you, too.
That's right. This is, please place item in bag. You're like, I did. What do I do?
I promise.
I think that's really kind of fascinating. And to me, that kind of hints at maybe those retailers that are taking like half steps and incremental steps kind of are the way, because maybe we're not ready for just a giant leap because we don't know what to do. Maybe we still do need a little bit of handholding in retail environments.
Right. And, you know, pretty much everyone I talked to said that, you know, they're convinced that we're eventually going to go this route of, you know, using more technology and, you know, having shoppers do a little bit more of the work when it comes to checkout themselves, just to try to get rid of that line. But it's going to take a few years at least before we're, you know, at the point where it's totally gone and we're all just walking in and out with no effort at all.
Yeah. And so I know you mentioned in the story that, you know, Amazon Go has reported pretty low losses. And I think that's always the big thing of, how do you know? You know, how I would feel like I was shoplifting. I feel like I've heard that kind of anecdotally around that kind of shopping environment a lot. So Amazon says, you know, no problem. No one's stealing from us. Is that across the board? Do retailers that you talk to, do they tend to report lower losses or losses about the same or higher in more of a honor system like this?
It's a little hard to say, in part because nobody, Amazon included, is, you know, giving out actual numbers for what this looks like. You know, when I talk to loss prevention experts, they will say that, you know, generally self-checkout is seen as being a little bit riskier from the store's perspective than traditional checkout counters. You know, both with a combination of, you know, people taking things intentionally and, you know, maybe only scanning two of the three bananas, or because, you know, they honestly made a mistake and it didn't scan right, or they forgot that thing at the bottom of the cart. And there's less data right now on the self-checkout systems like Meijer has, where you scan with your own mobile device as you're walking through the store, just because they're much newer than the old kiosk systems. But I think generally most would say that there's reason to think that that would be even riskier when it comes to losses, just because at least at the kiosks, you know, you can have an employee there who's sort of keeping an eye on people as they're scanning, you know, even if they're watching multiple machines. But when someone's walking through and scanning as they go through the store, it's just really hard to keep an eye on everything everybody's doing.
Yeah, indeed. And I've been thinking about this very topic. So your piece at Chicago Tribune really jumped out at me because I was watching an Instacart employee, you know, an Instacart worker the other day in the store just kind of zipped through, and I was like, wow, this guy must be real. He knows everything in the store. He must be here a lot. He was just zipping along, scanning stuff. It seemed like he maybe had a couple different things running, and he like had it down to a science. And I was wondering how that kind of technology will eventually blur into here and affect our own shopping of how we'll be doing that. So it's all really interesting. I said it early on the program. I think it's so interesting where technology and consumer behavior and retail all kind of converge is a really interesting place right now.
Absolutely. There's a lot going on, and Meijer's the latest with the new smartphone feature, but I'm sure there will be more.
I'm sure there will be. Well, we will keep turning to you for the latest indeed. Lauren Zumbach, business reporter at Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much for being with us again today.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all the good stuff, and we have a little bit longer show today, so we're going to be talking with you up until 1:30 when I turn you over to Chris Bowden for pregame. So when we come back on the other side of news, we're going to be talking about with Danny Ecker from Crane's Chicago Business about co-working spaces like WeWork and those kind of things, right? Their expansion in big cities, especially in Chicago, it might kind of come to a screeching halt because there's not a lot of room. We're going to be talking about that in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate you. We're going a little bit longer today. We normally wrap things up at 1 o'clock. We're going up until 1:30, and at which time I will turn you over to Chris Bowden for the Blackhawks pregame. Lots going on there. But right now, we are joined by Danny Ecker, who covers commercial real estate over at Crane's Chicago Business. And for those of you who listen during the week, I do Crane's Daily Gist podcast for the fine people at Crane's. And I talked about this next story a little bit on the show this past week because I think it is really, really interesting about how co-working spaces like WeWork and brands like that, their expansion in cities here like our fine city of Chicago might come to a halt because space is suddenly really at a surprising premium. Danny, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Amy. How are you?
Good. So I think this story is so interesting because I feel like every time we look up, like a new co-working space is popping up, and there was even news of a luxury premium one that's coming to the city. So we don't think about space being at a premium, especially when we're seeing giant buildings go up and things like that. But the particulars around and kind of everything that needs to happen to put a co-working space in a building kind of knocks out a lot of other space, which is really fascinating. So talk us through that, if you would.
Yeah. So, I mean, the whole co-working, trend has just been fascinating in itself because this thing has spread like crazy. Every other week there's another WeWork or Industrious or Spaces. I mean, there's all these different brands of co-working providers, and they just keep popping up. because there is so much demand. They're offering flexible, you know, month-to-month leases that companies like, even if you're a big company that wants to, you know, just have a little tech team that's based out of a co-working facility. So, you know, it's just been, they're popping up everywhere. So the interesting thing about a lot of these co-working leases, the deals that these co-working companies strike with landlords and office landlords downtown, is that a lot of them have non-compete agreements where they basically say, all right, I'm WeWork, for example, and I, you know, have three floors in your building. Even though it's a 40-story building, I want to make sure that you cannot have another co-working provider in the building. So even though I have three floors, I'm taking 40 floors off the market when I do a deal with you. So that's been happening quite a bit. And the folks at Cushman & Wakefield, which is one of the top brokerages, they put together a little study that said, all right, let's look at all the top quality buildings, office buildings in downtown Chicago, see how many of them have those type of non-compete agreements with a co-working provider, and see how much space is actually left, because this thing is, again, just spread everywhere. It's just, it seems like every building, you know, if you ask the landlord, well, who's your co-working provider, they would either have one or they'd say, well, we're not on board with that trend. And so it eliminates a lot of the options. And so it's sort of this artificial ceiling, I guess, to the growth of co-working. And so it's a lot of interesting ways that could play out.
Indeed. And then there's the piece of how many square feet needs to be available for a co-working space, because it's not like, I mean, by virtue of what it is, it needs to have a lot of room there.
Right, right. Yeah, the study that Cushman & Wakefield put together, they said that they didn't count any space that didn't have at least 25,000 square feet of contiguous space available. They didn't count those as eligible space, which is, I mean, there are a lot of buildings that have, that's just one floor, you know, 25,000 square feet. So, you know, that's kind of how they went about it. And, you know, one of the things they kind of concluded was, well, this basically, if you spin this forward and if co-working keeps spreading at the rate it has recently, you know, you're going to start to see either some consolidation, which you may see anyway because it's such a fragmented industry. You know, they said they counted at least 30 different co-working providers, all the way from like the WeWorks of the world down to, you know, some that just have a one small location. So you're going to either see, you know, some companies gobbling up others, or maybe some of these providers don't make it, and that opens some space back up on the market. So it's just kind of interesting to see where the limits of this land grab lie.
Yeah, it will be interesting to kind of watch it continue to play out, too. Did you get the sense in reporting this story that there were any like potential lease amendments where maybe landlords starting to think, hey, this is not quite fair, I don't love this? Because as you point out in the story, I thought this was a really interesting number, that as a result of this, with like having these non-competes and leases and things like that, co-working providers essentially kind of control more, and I'm doing radio air quotes when I say control,
yeah,
18 times the amount of space they actually lease in the central business district, which is so interesting to think of it in those terms of, you know, you're paying for this amount and you have this, and yet, therefore, this much room is not eligible. So did you get the sense that anyone is looking at maybe the way these leases are done or anything like that?
Not really. I mean, it is something that's, I don't think it's unique, but it's almost unique to co-working. I mean, most industries, if you have law firms, you could have plenty of different law firms in a building. And, you know, that's true for across most different sectors. But, you know, as far as the leases go, it's really interesting. So you have two different classes, and this has been one of the most fascinating things to watch with co-working, is you have the class of landlords that have totally embraced it and done leases with these co-working providers and said, I want to make sure I have flexible space. It's good for my tenants. It fills vacancy that I have. It's good for my tenants because if they want to grow, they can kind of use that as some flexible space from other tenants in the building. Then you have other landlords who have totally shunned co-working altogether, and they are concerned that, you know, when the economy softens up a little bit, that co-working providers are not going to be the most credit-worthy tenants, and they're a little nervous about signing a lease to fill a bunch of space with co-working, and then, hey, what if that co-working provider goes under? Then they've all of a sudden got a bunch of space they need to fill. So it's been very polarizing, and that's been interesting to watch. And so I think as you see the landlords approach these leases, and they're not all saying, well, we need to eliminate non-compete agreements. I don't think this is really a big issue for a lot of them, but there's another side to it, which is that some of these landlords are trying to do co-working themselves. They're saying, you know what, I see what WeWork does, I see what Industrious does and Spaces and all their rivals. you know, CBRE, which is another brokerage, and they have an investment side that they own some buildings too. They launched their own version of it, and they said, "Well, we'll just do it ourselves. You know, we'll create this co-working space and amenities that people like these days." Same thing with Tishman Spire. That's another big Loop office building owner. They launched their own version of it. So you're starting to see landlords maybe not so much say, okay, we want to open this up, but they say, well, you know what, co-working, we can just do our own and maybe potentially have WeWork or another provider in there too.
That's really interesting. And this is why we turn to you for the latest in all this, to make sense of it for us, because it's such an interesting thing, and I feel like it will come to a head sooner or later, and that'll be really interesting. I want to switch topics, though, before I let you go, because there was some breaking news. I know I got my Crane's business alert this morning on my phone about Sterling Bay back in the news. I feel like every 48 hours doesn't go by without us talking about Sterling Bay, but they have proposed a 47-story Michigan Avenue tower that a lot of people are talking about this morning. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, so it just, like you said, it never ends with Sterling Bay. I mean, they're not only are they, you know, in the final stages of trying to get city approval for this $6 billion Lincoln Yards mega project on the north side, but, you know, this is a pretty high profile project they proposed here themselves. So 47 stories. This is 300 North Michigan Avenue, which, you know, if people know that's it's south of the Chicago River. It's right there. Right now it's an old vacant brick building that Sterling Bay has been sitting on for about half a decade. Nothing there, and they're proposing to knock it down and put a combination of hotel rooms and residential units there. And I mean, this would be a really, really, you know, I guess really, really high profile, very visible building right there on Michigan Avenue. And it's interesting, especially because, you know, that portion of Michigan Avenue has just totally blossomed in the past, I mean, really since the recession, I guess you could say. I mean, there's new hotels, there's a brand new luxury apartment building that opened up a couple years ago. So, you know, the whole Mag Mile being the center of gravity for hospitality and tourists, that's shifting a little bit. And you have the cultural mile, as some people call it, you know, of around Millennium Park and this area along Michigan Avenue that there's a lot of development on. So that's what Sterling Bay is buying into, and they still need approval for this, so they don't have all the clearance to do this building, but you know, a really another ambitious plan from Sterling Bay.
Yeah, no shortage of ambition from this company at all.
Yeah,
so much of it. So I this morning on the way into the radio station, I went and found that building because I could not picture in my head, where is 300 North Michigan? It's gonna be right here,
right?
And it is very, it's like a maybe 4-story, very nondescript little brown building. I think that was at one time, I think there was a Radio Shack and a 7-Eleven on the ground floor of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
the
one.
The Walgreens and a Radio Shack and a Subway.
Yeah. So it's got.
And then.
So it's got London House kind of up to the north at Wacker in Michigan. And then right across the street there is the St. Jane that used to be the Hard Rock Hotel. And it's a building like you walk by a million times, and it's just kind of nondescript, and there it is. And then when you look at these architectural renderings of what this proposed building is, it's really something. It would be quite a change.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what Sterling Bay really has built its reputation on is, you know, taking these nondescript old brick buildings that, you know, in a lot of cases, redeveloping them and kind of still using their bones, like they've done in the West Loop, but this would just be a straight demolition and rebuild. But, you know, that's what they've done. They've kind of are masters of taking some of these outdated buildings and finding new life for them, and that's a really high-profile site, obviously. And, you know, it's interesting also with Sterling Bay, because they, after kind of building their reputation on those, you know, industrial buildings that they got, especially in the West Loop, and bringing Google to Fulton Market and McDonald's, you know, now they've expanded into these really high-profile properties. You know, they bought Prudential Plaza last year, and they own the Groupon headquarters at 600 West Chicago. And, you know, they've just really, obviously Lincoln Yards now is on the plate. So they're just kind of growing, and they become, you know, the busiest, maybe the most prolific developer right now in Chicago.
Indeed. Well, as commercial real estate reporter, they're certainly keeping you busy. Hopefully you'll have a day off one of these days, Danny, for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know when that day will be, but eventually you will. Well, Danny Ecker, thanks so much for being with us today. Always appreciate your time.
Thanks, Amy. Have a good one.
You too. All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll just chat a little bit, talk about, I got a follow on some of these stories I want to talk with you about, and then we're going to turn things over to Chris Bowden for Blackhawks pregame at 1:30. All that's coming up in just a bit here on 720 WGN. take that jump. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, the extended edition of the Business Lunch today. We're going up a couple more minutes, up until 1:30. I'm going to turn you over to Chris Bowden for Blackhawks pregame. Lots to talk about there. Getting ahead of getting ready for the game this afternoon. All that good stuff. Then I will be back here at from 8 to 9 p.m. for an abbreviated version of the Saturday Night Special. I wanted to touch on a couple of topics that we talked about on the show today. We opened the show talking about the red swing line stapler from Office Space. A lot of texters talking about that. I think that movie is so interesting because it still holds up. That movie, Office Space, is 20 years old, and yet people still say, yeah, in a certain way that we know means no. If someone asks you a question, you go, yeah, no, right? Or, I'm going to need you to go ahead and, like, we all know that's from Office Space. TPS reports, still a thing, right? Not long ago, I was hearing people talking on an L train, talking about how one woman was kind of debating taking this job, and she said, well, it's really good money. I just think I'd be bored. I don't know. I don't want to sit around making TPS reports all day. And I was like, how interesting that, and the woman speaking, she was probably in her mid-20s, and here's this movie that's 20 years old now. And for her, that was still like part of her, you know, part of her knowledge base and part of her thing. So I think that's a fascinating film that has held up nicely. And I'm glad there are red swing line staplers in the world now. As we talked about earlier in the program with Corinne Pertil from Quartz, who wrote this piece, how when that film came out, swing line did not make a red stapler, and they were kind of reluctant to do so because, you know, there's a little bit of profanity in that film. And as she notes in the piece, the stapler is not exactly the hero. It's sort of this, you know, this like icon of despair and work angst by this, you know, bumbling employee. And, but now they have come along and they have created a red swing line stapler. It's $50. That's a lot for a stapler. I've got a little $1.99 stapler that's tiny. That's like a little bitty one that only holds about 7 staples at a time. But you know what? You don't need staples that much in the world, right? Most of our things are digital and they're on screens and all that. So I don't find myself needing a stapler. That said, they are reissuing like the swing line stapler that's going to look just like the one in the film. And I think that's pretty cool. And it's not going to be $50. If it's, I don't know. What's a reasonable amount to pay for a stapler? Ashley, what would you pay for a stapler? Would you pay $50 for a stapler? Surely not.
No, I'd probably pay like 15.
15.
Most.
Okay. For like the iconic,
yeah,
red,
like
swing
iconic
line.
Maybe 20.
Okay. So we are in different age groups. I'm going to say that as diplomatically as I'm going to say that. I'm a lot older than you. How do you connect to that film, Office Space?
You know, I've seen the movie a long time ago with my family. So every time I think of that movie, I just think of my family time, even though you're right, it is kind of a risky film to watch with your family. But it's really funny. It's literally sitting in my room right now in one of my movie bins.
Because it's funny.
And it's you
so
know,
funny.
It's just, yeah, it's fun. That's the best way to put it. And I saw it when I was really young. Not like really young where it's like weird or like bad to watch that kind of film, but like too young to be watching something like that with my family. So
sure. I mean,
bonding.
I think, I still quote that film all the time. Like,
oh, yeah.
If I'm trying to say like, I'm not going to mess with that, or I can't be bothered. Not a work thing, but like just a life thing. If someone's like, oh, hey, we're all going to go to this thing. I'm like, I don't want to go to that. And I usually will say, I'll say that thing about like, it's not that I'm lazy, Bob. It's that I just don't care. It's like, it's that one.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's so fascinating how that film has just kind of stayed in our sight lines so well.
So quotable. It really is.
So quotably. And it's so quotable. And it's funny to think of that. I mean, that was such an early career Jennifer Aniston film, right? But I don't know, for anybody who's ever waited tables, I know I certainly identified with the moment when she quits, gives the middle finger to the boss, and she's like, I've had it with the flair, and the, you know, because he was like fussing at her for not wearing enough buttons on her. But they didn't call it Fridays in the film, they called it some other, but it was basically, you know, the red and white striped shirt with the, you know, the suspenders and the buttons and pieces of flair. And she just goes off on that manager, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I've so waited tables in a place like that. It was just that same feeling of like, oh, I'm so done. Anyway, friends, we are going to get you to break, and then we're going to turn things over to Chris Bowden for the Blackhawks pregame. Then I will be back here after White Sox Weekly for an abbreviated version of the Saturday Night Special from 8 to 9. So I will see you then. But for now, let us take a little break, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.